Hello and welcome to Forum. I'm Roshan Hamasaleh, and this is the topical debate show where the people ask the questions. Today, in the immediate aftermath of the Annapolis talks, the question is topical indeed. Does Palestine have a future? Some things about last week were encouraging. The Bush administration finally became more engaged in the Israel-Palestine issue, something most believe essential for progress. Ehud Olmert and Mahmoud Abbas shook hands. What started at Annapolis a few days ago has been described by some as potentially the last chance for a two-state solution. But is the second of those states, a united Palestine, still even a possibility? In the last 2 years, Palestine has been splintered. Hamas, which was not invited to Annapolis, taking charge of Gaza, Fatah retaining the West Bank, itself carved up by ever more Israeli settlements. The Palestinian Prime Minister's power to act has been seldom less. Can there be any settlement without Hamas? Over the last few months, not much noticed by the West, life in Gaza has become ever worse thanks to Israeli blockades of fuel, sometimes electricity and even water. The Israelis say it's retaliation for Hamas attacks on their territory. For the Palestinians, it's an illegal collective punishment. Meanwhile, more and more territory is being earmarked by Israel. So is there really any hope, or is this just another photo opportunity? To discuss these issues, I'm joined by a distinguished panel. To my right, Charlie Wolf, a British-based American broadcaster who's lived in the UK for the last 20 years. To his right, Ian Black, The Guardian's Middle East editor and columnist. Ian has just come back from the Annapolis Middle East Summit. To my left, Dr. Makram Khoury. Mahul is an academic at Cambridge University, specializing in the Middle East and the media. To his left, Sharif Nashashibi, who's the chairman and co-founder of Arab Media Watch, an independent non-profit watchdog pursuing a balanced and fair coverage of Arab issues in the media, or that's what they say anyway. Welcome to you all. Okay, as usual, we're going to kick off with questions from the audience. And the first question, I believe, comes from Mr. Jonathan Cates, who is a student at SOAS.
Yes, thank you all for coming. Of course, one of the main goals of the Annapolis Conference is to achieve a Palestinian state which can be recognized by Israel. And as you mentioned, of course, in the negotiations at Annapolis, Hamas was... refused to come, and they were not invited either. My question is, how serious an obstacle is Hamas to the achievement of a settlement? And do you think Hamas has the ability to disrupt the peace process at this point?
Okay. Charlie, can you kick off with that question, please?
Yes. I think Hamas is a serious impediment to the peace process, unfortunately. They refused to recognize Israel, and ultimately Hamas is a terrorist group, which is a shame. So I think that's a major impediment, and I think that's one of the reasons why they weren't there, and as you mentioned, they didn't want to go anyway. Unfortunately, there are other serious impediments to peace in the Middle East. One only has to look at the Syrians. I don't think they're too much in favor, nor are their proxies, which include Hezbollah. I don't think the Iranians, to be fair, are all too much interested in peace in the area. And again, look at their proxies. You have Hezbollah and Hamas, who they fund. So I see them both as major roadblocks. And again, as long as they are promoting terrorism, incitement, hatred, I don't think this thing can move forward, unfortunately.
But can it move forward without them?
It's
possible. Because they're major players in the region, aren't they?
It's possible. I think that the people have to divorce themselves from groups like Hamas. They have to reject Hamas as what it is, which again is a terrorist group. I think it's unfortunate when you look at the situation the Palestinians were dealt in the last elections. You had Fatah, which was corrupt. And I know that some would argue that, well, the vote for Hamas wasn't so much because they're a terrorist organization, but because they were supposedly an alternative. But you know the Palestinians to find, I think, someone that third party that's going to A, be strong, and B, is going to move forward, is going to reject things like terrorism.
Dr. Makram?
Well, I think that any serious talk about the situation in Palestine-Israel should take into account all players on the ground. Hamas, they were elected democratically. The fact that later on what happened in Gaza, this is a completely different story. But we're not talking here about a marginal group of 10 people sitting in the Shatta camp. We're talking here about a substantial and sizable number of the Palestinians who chose to elect Hamas. And if we are really Democrats or believe in the normative approach of democracy, it's only right to accept the will of the Palestinians, which was, of course, as even President Carter said, was quite democratic, and invite Hamas for talks. The Fatah-led government today by President Mahmoud Abbas, in as much as he represents the Palestinian legality, frankly speaking, and according to Palestinian constitution, Fatah does not represent all Palestinians. We do need to ask the other section of the Palestinians in order to perhaps bridge the gap in the internal Palestinian political arena. We can't have Gaza and the West Bank divided according to geographical and political lines. We have to talk about internal reconciliation, which can certainly take place, chiefly if external powers with interests and agendas stop too much interfere in the Palestinian political home. And then I think that we can make progress internally, and this can have an impact externally on the region and internationally.
Ian Black, Hamas, a terrorist organization, according to Charlie Wolf, can a settlement be achieved without them?
Well, I think the original questioner, Jonathan, I think it was, said, was Hamas an obstacle to a settlement? Well, you know, you could ask that question about virtually all the participants in this conflict. Hamas is an obstacle to settlement, but settlements are an obstacle to settlement too. So I would answer the question in a slightly different way. I mean, people have already said Hamas was elected in the general elections of January 2006 with 44% of the Palestinian vote. That's quite a lot of people. If Hamas's main is in the Gaza Strip as it is today, there are 1.4 million people living there. To dismiss it simply as a terrorist organization is frankly nonsense and misses the point. Hamas has used terrorist methods. There's no question about that. The question is how you actually go about achieving a solution to this conflict when the Palestinians are as divided, more divided than they've ever been, perhaps since the 1930s. And what you do about addressing the causes, the root causes which brought about the increasing support for this organization. And I think it is perfectly reasonable to say, and plenty of analysts agree, that Hamas achieved the success that it did a couple of years ago because of years of failure, the failure of their own, the leadership of the Palestinians, the PLO, after the Oslo agreements, the failure of anything approaching a peace process. And people were desperate. They saw no hope at all. And they voted for an organization which promised liberation and it promised resistance. Hamas means the Islamic Resistance Movement. People wanted to resist to achieve their goals. Their goals weren't being achieved in other ways. It seems to me you have to go back to what brought them into power and what fed their ideology. Now, I'm sure people will have their own views about the role of Islam and politics and political Islam and all those things. I suggest that it helps to look at Hamas in the context of the Palestinian reality. And violence, of course, has been part of that reality on all sides for a very long time. You know, so that would be my starting point. That doesn't begin to answer the question exactly, but I think that's a way of looking at it, perhaps.
Before I come to Sharif, I'm just going to go back to Charlie. If you can accuse Hamas of terrorism, can't all parties be accused of terrorism? Yeah, you know, Hamas is the only party that's not been invited to the talks. Mm. And if you do a body count, some would say that Israel have killed far more innocent civilians than Hamas has.
I think there's a major difference there. Israel have been doing that in trying to defend their territory and defend their people. I think the problem is, and I think Makram hit a lot on it, is nothing is going to happen until the Palestinians, if I can use the term, get their act together. You know, you're right. You can't have a divided nation. You can't have half going with Fatah and half going with Hamas, whether You know, actually, they're both...
The same situation exists in Israel, whereas actually you have at least four divisions between right, far right, center-left, and left. So, and still, we don't... Nobody accuses Israel that it can't actually operate because there is internal division.
No, that's but that's party political difference. I think that's a major difference to where you have the West Bank is controlled by Fatah and their gunmen. Hamas is controlling Gaza by, as we saw a couple of months back, throwing people off the tops of buildings. You know, one of the other things you need before we can proceed, there's more to this than just elections. People keep on saying about elections. Elections come down the line. A democracy needs certain factors. It needs rule of law to start with. It needs an independent judiciary, etc. And the situation we're seeing in Gaza especially, which is unfortunate, is showing no rule of law. You have to have someone that's eventually in charge, so when a negotiation happens,
we'll come
back
to this point later.
They speak to the people.
I've got to bring Sharif in. All right, so Sharif, for the Palestinians, I've got to get their act together.
You know, I really do find this kind of mindset, not just condescending, but quite colonialist, that you are hijacking the freedom of millions of people because you are not happy with whether you think the Palestinians have got their act together or not. That really shouldn't be the point. The point is the Palestinians have a right to self-determination. Whether you like the nature of the state or party politics or whatever that comes up is really besides the point. When you look at, for instance, the example of South Africa, there were never any such demands placed on the ANC in their search for the end of apartheid. Okay, the rights of black people in South Africa were recognized regardless of the methods used by the ANC and regardless of any concerns as to what might happen after apartheid ended. So you really can't dangle, you know, things in front of the Palestinians and say, well, if you're not democratic, you're going to stay under occupation. If you're not this, you're going to stay under occupation. You know, they have a right to their freedom, and it is not up to Americans or anyone else, and certainly not Charlie, to tell me that my people have to remain in this way, you know, until you're happy with that.
Sharif, what would it accomplish, again, to give them borders and have a failed state? Right now, the Palestinians are having trouble ruling themselves.
The Palestinians are under occupation. They cannot rule themselves. I mean, are you talking about
they've been able to rule themselves for years. Why do you think it's the Palestinian Authority
Gaza is blockaded from the rest of the world. The West Bank and Gaza are still technically under occupation. They are attacked on a daily basis.
They're not blockaded from Egypt.
Israel, at will, and the UN has complained about this, at will, closes the border with Egypt. It's been closed more than it's been open since they were...
Why is that? Rockets are going off every day.
But I'm going to have to bring in the audience. First of all, Jonathan, going back to you, what do you make of what... You asked the question, what do you make of what the panel just said?
I have to question the legitimacy of Hamas myself, and... I heard a number of points. Does Hamas have the right to self-determination? The Palestinians have the right to self-determination? Yes. Was Hamas freely elected? Yes. But does that give them the right to commit terrorism? Absolutely not. That's the reason why they were not invited to the Annapolis conference. That is the reason why they are considered a terrorist group by the United States and other countries.
Okay, thanks. Let's take a couple more questions before we move on to the next question. A couple more responses from the audience. The gentleman over there, please.
Hello, yeah. Thank you for all attending. I think that some of the comments made are quite ironic, especially considering the fact we're talking about democracy. I mean, on one hand, you're saying we need a democracy in the Islamic world, and when we finally do achieve it, then you're saying that's not a viable state. I mean, it harks back to the time when Musaddiq took the rule of Egypt, and he wasn't good enough at that time, so you got rid of him. So, you know, make up your mind. Do you want a democracy in the Islamic world? If so, accept it. If not, just be quiet about it.
Charlie, very briefly.
Well, again, a democracy is more than just having an election. A democracy means you keep to certain norms. And again, for the sake of the Palestinian people, you shouldn't have to worry, as a resident of Gaza, about being thrown off the top of a building by some thug from Hamas. So there's a lot of things that involve the creation of democracy. One vote does not make a democracy.
Okay, let's move on to the next question, which I believe is going to be posed by Sami Ramadan, who is also a student.
Yes, hello, thank you all for coming. The question is to the panel. Do you think that the very existence of a Jewish state in the former land of Palestine will ever be accepted by Arab countries and by Muslims in general?
So going back, Ian Black, going back to the roots of this whole issue, will Israel ever be accepted by a large, perhaps majority, of the Muslim world?
It's a difficult question to answer. I think one of the striking things about this conference in Annapolis the other day was the presence, I would say the unprecedented number of Arab and Muslim countries who ever came to a conference like that involving Israel. I mean, the nearest thing we had to that before, correct me if I'm wrong, fellow panelists, was the Madrid conference in 1991. And I think Annapolis, there were 16 Arab countries, the whole of the Arab League representing all 22 members was represented there. I think Indonesia, Malaysia, also there. So I think you would have to point to that as evidence on the part of governments of Arab and Muslim countries to attend a conference which is explicitly to discuss the Israeli-Palestinian issue.
But how many of them actually recognize Israel? Not many, surely.
No, very few of them actually recognize Israel. But I mean, it's an important distinction to make, but nevertheless, the countries that recognize Israel are three, I would say. There is Jordan and Egypt, which have their peace treaties, and Mauritania in the far west of the Maghreb. The other countries don't have diplomatic relations with Israel.
Do you think that's going to change in 20 years' time? Are we going to see half of the Muslim world, or half the countries in the Muslim world, the 53 countries, or how many they are, actually recognizing Israel?
I think things are heading that way. I think Annapolis was an interesting signpost in that direction. I think it was fascinating to see Saudi Arabia, with all its weight and wealth and importance, and its obviously its significance as the guardian of the Muslim holy places, represented there in Annapolis at a very high level. And I think if you look around the Arab world, you see that there is an acceptance, a pragmatic acceptance, if you like, that Israel, whether they like it or not, and one leaves that question open, is there as a reality. And one sees in the actions of Arab governments that they want there, desperately they want there to be a resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. Now, you could make an important distinction perhaps between the Arab governments and the Arab street, as is often said in the Middle East. And there you raise questions about how representative are those governments. But at the level of governments, yes, I think you do see that. Is that a pointer to the future? Maybe. I think a lot depends on what happens over Palestine.
Sharif, I'm going to bring you here, and I'm going to ask you to be reasonably quick because we're coming up to a break. Sharif, Ian paints quite an optimistic picture in terms of Muslim states recognizing Israel. Do you think the Muslim people will ever recognize Israel, come to acceptance of its existence?
Well, that wasn't his question. His question was whether Arabs and Muslims would accept a Jewish state. And that's not necessarily the same as accepting Israel and recognizing Israel. I think if you look at Arabs in general in the region, and not just Arabs, I mean, if you look at Iran and Turkey, whatever, the idea of accepting Israel as a democratic state is much easier than accepting Israel as a Jewish state. So there's a difference there. Because once you recognize Israel as a Jewish state, you are potentially undermining the rights and status of its non-Jewish citizens, which are currently one-fifth of the population and growing much faster than the Jewish population. So if you recognize Israel as a democratic state, you are safeguarding the rights of its non-Jewish citizens. If you recognize it as a Jewish state, that's a different matter.
So as an Arab and a Muslim, given the way that Israel was created, you would be willing to accept the state of Israel?
As a democratic state for all its citizens, but as a Jewish state, I can't accept that its Christian and Muslim citizens would have a second-class status. I can't accept that, and I'm not saying that as an Arab and a Muslim. I'm against theocracies, what be they Jewish, Muslim, or Christian. But any state should treat all its citizens equally. And if a state is recognized on the basis of what religion you're from, I just can't accept that. That's discrimination.
Charlie Wolf?
I don't think
that's discrimination.
No, it doesn't. Israel has a basic law of a freedom of religion. Matter of fact, I think a Muslim is more free to worship as one wishes in the state of Israel than they do in some of the Arab states or some of the Muslim states where there is a theocratic government. And sometimes if you're not Muslim to the extent of how, say, the Taliban would have wanted you to have been, you weren't Muslim, you were kafir. At least in Israel, you have a freedom of religion. And to say that there shouldn't be a Jewish state, I mean, Afghanistan, Algeria, Azerbaijan, Bahrain, Bangladesh, Brunei, Iran, Iraq, Jordan, Kuwait, Maldives, Mauritania, Morocco, Oman, Pakistan,
Qatar. Don't read the whole list.
These are Muslim states. So if they can be Muslim states, why can't there be? This is of the Jewish nation. This is when it refers to the Jewish state. It refers to a people, not necessarily a religion. Within the Jewish religion, just as within Islam, there are many different branches and different levels of observance. So I don't think that should
But getting back to the question, do you believe that Muslims on the street and governments will come to an acceptance of Israel at some point? Given the way that Israel was created and the refugees, the dispute over the holy sites, etc. And these are intractable problems that are going to last a century, surely.
I agree to an extent with Ian. I think governments will start to see where it's in their interest. I think one of the things that is holding this back, unfortunately, is as long as, especially in the Palestinian areas, as we know, as long as incitement and hatred are being taught, as long as we're finding that in school books where Jews are being equated with apes and pigs and so forth and so on, then that's not going to move forward. They have to get this out of their hearts and then let everyone work together and move forward.
Dr. Makram?
Well, I think that one shouldn't overlook the sensitivity of the Arab societies regarding any concessions made to Israel. Let's start with the visit of the late president, Egyptian president Anwar Sadat in 1979 to the Knesset. What it led in the eyes of the Arab public to Israel's invading Lebanon for 18 years. And later on, the concession that the Palestinians made in Oslo in 1993 led to the assassination of Rabin. And since then, the whole process actually has stopped. So we have to, in as much as we are focusing on the ad, I think that we've got to go back to understand the internal Israeli politics, including the fact, Charlie, that Jews until this very moment, and Israelis, they haven't decided who is Jewish. I'm sure you are aware of this. Constitutionally, for example, we don't know at the moment who is Jewish in Israel. But let's go back to the main core. It's not for the Arabs to decide whether Israel exists or doesn't exist. Israel is a fact for the moment. But what we do have to ask is, has Israel at all acknowledge the right of a Palestinian state to exist? No, until now. We haven't seen such a thing.
Okay, before we go to a break, Sami, if I can take it, what do you make of what the panel just said?
Yeah, I agree. It's a very hard question. I come from Egypt myself, and as it was said, there is a peace treaty, but like from what I can see on the streets, there's a very big difference between what the government thinks and what the people think. So I think it's a very hard question. We'll have to wait and see.
Okay, and the lady in the back in the hijab?
I'm just wondering if there wasn't any pressure on these countries like Saudi Arabia, which has been invaded by America. They've got their AVAXes there and other countries where they've got their forces, the deployment forces there. I wonder if
I'm going to have to go to a break, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're going to go straight to a break. Okay, we're going to go into a short break now, but we'll be back soon, so please do stay with us for part two of Forum. Welcome back to Forum. We're discussing today in the immediate aftermath of the Annapolis talks, does Palestine have a future? And we're going to go straight to our audience again to a question from Mehri Nikam. Sorry for mispronouncing your name. You're an executive director of the Joseph Interfaith Foundation. What's your question, please?
That's correct. I would like to ask a positive question rather than a negative one, because that's what we work towards. As a major UK-based Muslim Jewish interfaith organization that believes in independent Israel and Palestine living side by side as peaceful neighbors with secure borders, and we do accept Jewish state of Israel, what can we do in this country to help towards achieving this aim?
Dr. Makram, is there anything that we can do in this country?
Well, we have to go back to the main sticking points, really. And in order to do so, let's just start with the 1948 Nakba Palestinian catastrophe. Since then, actually, the name Palestine, the term Palestine, has become the most elastic name in modern history. And this, of course, depending on your political leanings. So in order to really give you perhaps a positive approach, we'll have to discuss five topics. Jerusalem, right of return, settlement, and resources, as well as borders. Once we have addressed these five points, I think we can make progress. But for the moment, and especially since the Oslo Agreement, what we have seen is that on the Palestinian side, they have been making concessions and nearly getting nothing. And on the Israeli political side, there is stagnation since the assassination of Rabin and then the election of Netanyahu and then Barak and Camp David and Sharon and the second Intifada. So what we have to do to go to these points, address them, and in particular, stopping this dragging settlements that actually are minimizing any chance for hope. If you look at the historical Palestine or at the map of historical Palestine, you see that in 48, nearly the overwhelming majority of the land belonged to the Palestinian inhabitants. Since then, they were displaced and dispossessed from most of the lands. And today, we are seeing a very shrinking Palestinian entity battered geographically and scattered in terms of population. So unless we address this, and your organization perhaps in particular, I'm afraid we're looking at a very difficult task here.
Okay, Sharif, you didn't actually answer the question really in terms of what the UK, we can actually do in this country. I believe that was the question, wasn't it? Maybe Sharif, you can answer that question.
I mean, we could always foster greater communication and cooperation between the communities in Britain, and that always helps, and it doesn't happen often enough, and there should be more of it. But there is a limit to how far that can go as long as the situation on the ground over there remains not just stagnant but deteriorating. So there's only so far that we can go here unless things improve over there. There's another issue that, I mean, I'm all for this kind of dialogue, and I get invited a lot to these kind of initiatives. My one misgiving with some of these initiatives is that when I'm asked to join, the premise of those initiatives is basically the idea that there is an equal suffering, equal responsibility, equal blame, equal victimhood. And I can't subscribe to that. It is not an equal conflict. You know, there is one party with all the power and one with none. There is one that's occupied and one that's an occupier. And I will happily join in dialogue as long as this inherent inequality is recognized and addressed.
Can I ask, just
as an example, one example of this. My first, I attended a conference in Washington. This was a few years ago. It was my first experience of this kind of initiative. And I was asked, there was a Palestinian man on the panel and an Israeli man on the panel. The Palestinian man had a five-year-old boy who was shot standing outside his house. The Israeli man, his son was a tank commander in the West Bank, and he was killed while on duty in the West Bank. I was being asked to see an equality between the Israeli man's son and the Palestinian man's son, although they died in such different circumstances, and I couldn't accept that, and this needs to change.
I'd actually like you to come back on that immediately, because you do run an interfaith foundation, and there was a bit of criticism of interfaith meetings and foundations, so what have you got to say to that?
Before I say about that, I would like to say that you gave an example of a man who lost his five-year-old son and the other one who lost his son as a tank driver. What about the five-year-old son of a man in Israel who dies as the result of rockets being fired into Israel by Hamas on a daily basis?
I'm against this, but this wouldn't
well,
happen
then,
if
then
there
you
is
have
a,
to
a,
look
a,
at it on the equal basis. You see, this is it. If there is suffering, is not the preserve of one side or another. When there is war, both sides suffer. And if we keep on harking back into my suffering is greater than yours, I have suffered more than yours, we will get nowhere. The acceptance is they have both suffered.
Okay, Dr. Mackel, very quickly, please.
Yeah.
Madam, we've got here a power struggle, let's face it. And we're talking about four types of power: economic, political, military, and symbolic, which is partly media. Economically, Israel is actually a superpower. Militarily, Israel isn't a clear superpower. And then politically, Israel is very close to the international center, namely New York and Washington. Media-wise, as well, the mainstream media all has been or have been in favor of Israel. So we're talking here about a powerless, stateless nation versus nearly, not only perhaps an international superpower, because they are the sixth most powerful army in the world, the Israelis. Okay. We're talking about
Basically, I think we've diverted from the question. I want to get back to the question, actually. Charlie and Ian first. Is there anything in this country that we can do? Does Gordon Brown have any influence whatsoever? I mean, the UK is just not a player in this, is it?
Well, I wouldn't dismiss the UK quite so easily. I would say this country is a member, permanent member of the UN Security Council. It's a leading member of the European Union. And it has, whether you like it or not, a special relationship of some kind with the United States. I would say ordinary people in this country, whether it's in interfaith dialogue or in any other way, can perform a simple but vital service if they care about the future of Israelis and Palestinians, which is to simply to reinforce the argument, the overwhelming argument of the need, the urgent need, I would say, for a two-state solution that recognizes the rights of both peoples to deal with a problem that is causing, feeding tremendous resentment in between communities, particularly amongst Muslims, inflaming community relations in this country and elsewhere in the world. To look at the experience of this country in dealing with what was, until recently, a very difficult conflict in Northern Ireland, where the government successfully managed over time, with patience and some wisdom, to isolate the extremists and to craft an agreement that addressed the wishes of the majority of people on both sides, which is the same in Israel and Palestine, who desperately want peace, who accept the need increasingly for that two-state solution, but don't believe it can ever be achieved. So people of goodwill should be supporting that idea, and they should be demanding from our own government that it do everything it can, and more than it has done hitherto, to achieve that goal. That's what I would suggest.
Charlie Wolf.
To a large part, I do agree with a lot of what Ian is saying. I think interfaith dialogue has its place. It does have to start somewhere. But I think where I maybe depart slightly from Ian is that our relations, I think, with the Middle East have to be stronger. We have, in essence, both the United States and Great Britain have been still rewarding terrorism, and it has to stop. We have to lay down some clear guidelines saying, considering the amounts of money, especially the United States gives to the Palestinians, and also the Israelis, but they give a large sum of money to the Palestinians, certain things have to be laid down. Again, I go back to if hate is being preached in schools, in textbooks, etc., then the money will stop flowing. Things have to be dependent.
If American weapons kill Palestinian civilians, where does that fall on?
American weapons. Now, again,
you're drawing an American weapon that goes to enforcing an occupation.
A couple things. Sorry. First off,
ship to Israel through the UK airport.
First off, hold on. Before we start playing equivalence games, the weapons that go to the from the United States to Israel are being used by a democratically controlled army in the protection
kill civilians.
Of No, come on. Come on.
Does it make any difference if they're democratic or not? It's what they do with the weapons, isn't it?
No.
I'm sure those civilians are really grateful they're killed by a democracy. There is a chain of command.
There are people there that are doing it defensively. It is not being used by people to purposely kill civilians. Many of the people that do get killed in Palestine, unfortunately, are not necessarily bystanders. They are people who are
terrorists.
Have
you ever read an Amnesty or Human Rights Watch report?
I've read it all. But we have rockets going off into Sudra every day.
Let's go
to
the audience.
Israelis trying to protect themselves.
Okay.
You've had your turn. You've got more say than anybody else in the audience. So let's go to the audience now. Yes, please. Would you like to make a point?
Just taking it forward from what was last mentioned, we see now an edited leave the government. Let's see what people on the ground are asking for. Recently, there's been much discussion from peace activists within Israel, as well as Palestinians, saying, let's move forward towards one single secular democratic state. It's getting lots of support from people on the ground, Palestinians who are realizing that this is probably the best short-term solution for them to have rights and live like human beings, and for Israelis who want peace and who want to start treating Palestinians like human beings. How feasible do you think this is?
We'll just come back to that later. It's a very interesting topic. It's a whole other area which we probably haven't got time for. The lady who I rudely cut off in the first part, could you finish perhaps making the point that I stopped you from making?
Well, no, this is a new one. I'd just like to say that the comparison, in my opinion, is wrong. We can't compare Northern Ireland to Israel and Palestine because Israel is an expansionist country. And does not recognize.
That's why they gave up the Gaza recently.
Sorry, can you finish making your point, please?
And Israel breeds hate. So how can you expect a victim to be called terrorist and the aggressor to be Democrats? It's wrong. And as long as we're comparing that, we expect the victims to accept whatever's coming to them.
A
quick response. If the Palestinians are victims, which I'm sure to an extent they are, unfortunately, in the main, they are victims of themselves.
Letting Israel.
They
were the only country in the world that accepted Israel. The Jews to go there. So they were the only country in the world that accepted the Jews with open arms.
Who's this?
Palestine.
I don't know what bearing that has on what's going on now. You made several points. So let me get to it. You made several points. First off, you said Israel is expansionist. Well, again, I go back to a year or 2 years ago when they totally moved out of the Gaza Strip, gave the Palestinians a fantastic opportunity to at least try and move forward and govern themselves. It's a prison of their own making. Before the Second Intifada, when they had a chance, and you look over the years, GDP in the West Bank grew by, I think, some 25%. Israel had put up some 7 universities. The place was moving forward. I didn't say it's perfect, but economically, the Palestinians and the Israelis need each other, and the Israelis would be glad to work with them. But as long as, unfortunately, people are sneaking through, trying to blow themselves up in pizza parlors, which has been demonstrated.
Why is that? As long as there is an occupation, you can't expect the occupied people to guarantee the security of the occupied.
We're going to move on to the next question because we're quickly running out of time.
It's not an occupation.
It's not an occupation.
You are making a mockery of this program.
We're going to move on.
And what did they do? They destroyed all the buildings.
Don't say anything about Sharif, please. We're going to go on to the next question, which is from Tariq Fuda. And can I ask the panelists to not talk over each other because we can't hear anything. One at a time, please, but we're going to move on to the next question, which is from Tariq Fuda, who is another student.
First, to correct Mr. Wolf on the point that he's incorrect about, while Israel moved 8,000 settlers out of Gaza, it then moved 16,000 new settlers into the major settlement blocks in the West Bank.
Okay, but that's not the question. What's the question?
The question is, during the Oslo Accords, Yitzhak Rabin said that any Palestinian entity to emerge would be less than a state, and in fact, the number of settlements doubled during that time. Meanwhile, Ehud Olmert has been saying in recent months that Israel will maintain the major settlement blocks around Jerusalem with the E1 plan and will continue to control the Jordan Valley, just breaking up all of the West Bank into small pieces. So my question is, how can we talk about the future of a Palestinian state given this situation?
Settlements, Ian Black, a major obstacle to peace, are they?
Tariq, your question is a very important one. Settlements are absolutely one of the core issues of the conflict that have to be resolved. The answer is we don't know how it will work out. We do know that in the last nearly successful, so near but yet so far round of negotiations that were conducted under Bill Clinton in the final days of his presidency and a little bit later at Tabor in early 2001, the agreements that were reached would have given the Palestinians 97, 98% of the West Bank and provision was being made, was being discussed, for land swaps so that Palestinians would have been compensated with land elsewhere that the Israelis wanted to keep in the settlements they built around Jerusalem. I don't think you're ever going to, if that would ever to return as a scenario, I think that would be the best outcome you could ever hope for. But you're right, it's a central question, and you're right that if there is to be a settlement, it has to be resolved something very close to those parameters that were agreed at the time, because anything less than that would not constitute what there has to be, which is a viable Palestinian state, which requires contiguity of some kind between the West Bank and Gaza, and not the West Bank divided into isolated enclaves where travel is virtually impossible.
But these are facts on the ground now. Israel's not going to start ripping down settlements, is it? I mean, what you just said is not likely to happen, is it?
Israel will have to remove some of its settlements. There's no question about that. There is no question about that. It'll be easier to do with the ones that are more isolated. It'll be harder to do with some of the larger ones. But if there is to be an independent, viable Palestinian state, Israel will have to remove many of those settlements. Yes.
Dr. Makram?
Well, I think that, you've got here these two approaches. One is feeding into the expansionist approach where Israel over time, and according, by the way, to statistics on this curve, since 48, there are less lands owned by Palestinians day by day. There wasn't a single minute, whether during negotiations or not, that Israel stopped the settlements. So as a matter of fact, we're talking here about very serious obstacle. So what will be left for the Palestinians to deal with? This is, and again, I agree with you, Ian, but there is one point that I'd like to underline. You said some of the settlements. So if we're talking about reconciliation here, where two-state solution will be accepted, still the settlements will interrupt and will be an obstacle, because most of the settlements surrounding Jerusalem, between Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Jerusalem and Ramallah, are actually in and occupied territories, including, of course, East Jerusalem. So they are actually a very important sticking point that Israel, if it really is serious about going into reconciliation, it's got to uproot all settlements occupied or built in the occupied territories since 67.
But they're not gonna take down all the settlements, are they? What kind of compromise can be reached?
Well, I don't know. I don't speak on behalf of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. I think it's a sticking point. We should stick to the international legalities. The fact is that Israel, whenever there is something that speaks in its favor, of course, waves with the international legality and UN resolutions. And when things have got to deal with the Palestinians, Israel has been overlooking and ignoring all these UN resolutions, starting from 181, the partition, 194, the return of refugees, 242, 67, 338, 73, and etc., etc. So we have to stop this erosion if we are really serious about reaching a reconciliation. You can't have the Palestinians having nearly only 13% of Palestine, historical Palestine, and Israel having 77%. This is really is not going to serve anybody.
Sharif, I mean, whether you like settlements or not, there are facts on the ground, and it would be political suicide for any Israeli prime minister to start ripping down places where hundreds of thousands of voters live.
Well, look, this is the problem with the discourse we're having now, is that we're looking at it from the needs and desires of Israel. Those settlements are illegal under international law. They have been deemed so since the first one was set up. So we have to look at it in terms of, what is international law here? It stipulates those settlements should never have been built. They're illegal. And that's what we should be looking at first. Now, Ian says that yes, Israel has to remove some settlements. It's no coincidence that the settlements Israel says it will refuse to leave are exactly those settlements that will keep Palestine divided. If you look at where they're placed on the West Bank, they were built, and not coincidentally, to keep those territories separated. If Israel keeps those settlements, a contiguous viable Palestinian state is not possible. I mean, if we are probably at this stage, because those settlements are so large, probably the only viable, and this would be a major Palestinian concession, was to offer those settlers in those major settlements Palestinian citizenship if they were willing to live within a Palestinian state. Then that could be offered to them. But if they were to remain part of a future Israeli state then Palestine as a contiguous viable state couldn't exist. So I think this is an option that needs to be considered as to whether these settlers would accept to be Palestinian citizens in a Palestinian state.
Charlie, I mean, even you must agree that the settlements, the settlement policy is something that Israel has done wrong. And basically they're going to have to address that problem for peace to be possible.
Well, a couple things. First off, just very briefly, when you refer to 242, for instance, it's not really fair, I think, to say that Israel is shunning it. 242 involves two parties.
Let's stick to settlements.
All right. But also, I was going to say the important thing, because I know, Markham, you were going on about the 67 borders. 242, and it's widely known, does not refer to the 67 borders. Israel won that land in a war that they were defending themselves against aggressors.
But what about settlements?
And they, all right, now, with settlements, it needs to be pointed out that Israel has in the past vacated settlements in peace deals. I think with Egypt, isn't it?
Yes, it has.
Tiny number, though, surely.
But it was still, it does show. Again, I go back to the Gaza. They picked up their sticks and they moved. Just to get to the main point.
I'll bring you in.
And sure, settlements obviously is an agenda and is going to need some negotiating. I don't think we're there yet. Again, I go back to some of our original comments. President Bush, when he spoke here back 3-4 years ago, when he spoke at Westminster Hall, said states are more than just drawing lines on a map. Now, I agree with you. Yes, it has to be a viable state. I'm in favor of a two-state solution, and they have to be. I don't want to see a dying state sitting on Israel's borders. It doesn't serve the Palestinians. It doesn't serve the Israelis. But I don't think we're even at that stage yet. I think there's so many other fundamentals we need to get to before we even get down to that.
Which will take, another 40 years?
Another 40 years. But we have to address issues of helping the Palestinians to better govern themselves. So they have someone
that speaks
for them.
And in the meantime, expanding on and having more settlements.
But no, we've seen the Israelis move settlements. Again, we're almost getting into sort of nitpicking. Bring the
person who asked the question in, please.
First of all, I think it's important to remember that the International Court of Justice ruled not only that are continuing to build settlements illegal, but actually should be considered a war crime under international law. And in fact, even if an agreement is reached which ignores international law under the Vienna Convention, it would be null and void anyway. So I think it's quite ridiculous to downplay the importance of settlements. And if you do actually believe in a two-state solution, then you have to believe that the settlement should be removed and Israel control over the Jordan Valley should.
I still go back to the point of, remember, this was territory that was won while defending themselves in a war. It has always been the international norm that people that win territory in a war generally get to keep it.
This is nonsense.
However, I can quote you an entire generals and say this was a war that
Israel started on its own terms.
It did not start.
Yes, it did. I can quote you several Israeli generals in the entire nonsense.
It's nonsensical.
Tariq, you should be on this panel.
I think it's quite ridiculous for anyone to claim they support a two-state solution when they're not addressing this issue. What Mr. Wolf supports is really a one-state solution, except that Palestinians won't have citizenship. They will be citizens of some tiny Palestinian state that has no control over borders or resources.
You're characterizing what I'm saying. I said I'm in favor of a two-state solution, and a two-state solution has to be viable.
But again, just
very briefly to finish my point, I think that's down the road.
Ian.
We're still talking about settlements. I agree that settlements are absolutely central to the whole question. And I also think that it is a matter of extreme urgency, both for the peoples involved and for the international community, to deal with this problem before it is too late. And I think it's very close to being too late. A lot of people think it's too late already.
We've come to the end of the show. So on that note, we must end today's debate, unfortunately, on the future of Palestine. Before we leave, I'd like to thank all of our panelists, our unruly panelists at sometimes. If you'd like to send in any comments to the show, make any suggestions, please do email us. Our email address is forum@presstv.co.uk. Goodbye, and we'll see you all again for another lively discussion next week.